Before we begin, I want to show everybody the true face of the five remembrances. Brother Sam, will you, Sam Warlick, will you stand up? And face your brothers and sisters. This is the face of the five remembrances. This is the face of ill health. And we know we almost, Sam almost, a couple of months ago, almost went to the other shore, came back. So this is also the face of death and old age. This is also the face of parting from loved ones. And this is also the face of, after all that is left for Sam is the results of his actions of body, speech, and mind. So it is important when we contemplate the five remembrances, we don't do them abstractly. So Brother Sam has been very kind over these last months to skillfully use his body to teach us that the five remembrances are not abstract or conceptual or philosophical, but they are real. And it is only because of his kindness that he has shown us the way. So please thank Brother Sam for showing us the truth of the Buddha's teaching on impermanence. Thank you. So every time he coughs, that's a bell of mindfulness. He's doing his best to wake us up. Thank you, Sam. Andy reminded me that we, I think as most of you know, there have been many retreats, traditionally on the final morning of retreat, instead of our usual chanting service, we do a five mindfulness, three refuge, five mindfulness trainings, recitation or transmission. I believe that most of you are aware of what these are. So just very simply, anybody can practice the Buddha's way. You don't need a card. You don't need a certificate to practice the Buddha's way. But at the same time, going back to the time of the Buddha, students of the Buddha, followers of the Buddha, wanted in some way to acknowledge their relationship and commitment to his family, to him and to his family. And so going back to the original time of the Buddha, when people asked to be his followers, and they said, you know, what sort of formal way can I express my commitment to join your family and practice your way, he himself gave forth the three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And what has traditionally been known as the five precepts, but in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, he's kind of calls them the five mindfulness trainings, and there's good reasons for that. But it's the same, just a little different. So the formal receiving of the three refuges and the five mindfulness trainings is an ancient tradition in the Buddhist path, and we continue that within our community. So tomorrow, if there's anyone in here who has not received the three refuges and the five mindfulness trainings, you can do so. And what I'd like is whether Bill, perhaps after the meditation before lunch, could meet with people upstairs who are interested in receiving the Three Refuges of Mindfulness, and the Five Mindfulness Trainings can meet with you so you could explain it a little more, and I can ask any questions about the meaning of the refuges and the trainings. So that would be right after meditation upstairs this morning. Since this is often a question, people sometimes ask, you know, can you take the trainings more than once or with more than one teacher? And the answer, there's no official answer, but just based on my experience, the answer is yes. One can take them perhaps because, you know, one took them years and years ago and it's sort of lapsed and they want to reconnect to the lineage and the Dharma in a new way, so they may take the refuges again. Also, people might have taken the refuges in the mindfulness trainings in another tradition, and often times when one enters a new tradition and enters into a new relationship with the teacher, one often receives refuge from that teacher. So in either case, if there's anyone who wants to, please, two things. One thing is meet with Bill afterwards. And the other thing, please, between now and tonight, put in the bell your name, address, phone number, and email. But also, most importantly, a short paragraph of your spiritual aspiration. One of the things that occurs when you've received the trainings is that you receive an ordination certificate. Actually, in the Buddhist tradition, the transmission and the receiving of the five mindfulness trainings and three refuges is considered an ordination. It's considered lay ordination in Buddhism. You've probably heard the Buddhist community is called the Fourfold Sangha. The Fourfold Sangha is the Sangha of lay men and lay women and monks and nuns. Upasakas and upasikas, bhikshus and bhikshunis. So that's the Fourfold Sangha, and they each have different kind of commitments, which are different. So to receive the Three Refuges and the Five Mindfulness Trainings is in the Buddhist tradition to receive a lay ordination. Oh, and the reason... And the reason I ask you to write that paragraph for your aspiration is because anyone who receives transmission will receive an ordination certificate. And in that certificate, you will receive a Dharma name. And I will choose that name for you, and I will base that really on your aspiration, to give you a name that both acknowledges, but also inspires. So anyhow, if you are interested in receiving transmission, please meet with Bill up in the interview room after the meditation, and also please sometime during the day put your aspiration and the things we just talked about in the bell. If there is no one to receive transmission, we will just do a recitation, which is also wonderful, tomorrow. So before we finish the sutra, dealing with the seven factors of awakening, this morning we began the practice of the third tetrad, the tetrad dealing with the four meditations dealing with the mind, and receive some questions about that. Let me just read these four. Again, as you know, many of you are in the intensive, and we're dealing with these quite intensely, and as well as these are excellent books, Thich Nhat Hanh, Breathe, You're Alive, Larry Rosenberg's Breath by Breath. Both excellent explanations, and the talks that I've given in the past at the last retreat, and I believe also from the intensive, are all available on the website. So there's lots of good information to guide you in your practice. breathing in and out, I'm aware of my mind. Breathing in and out, I make my mind happy. Or it's also translated as, I gladden my mind. Breathing in and out, I concentrate my mind. Breathing in and out, I liberate my mind. So these are the four practices related to the mind. In a certain way, the mind is a mystery. It has its own ways of unfolding. Right? And anyone who spends time watching their mind during the course of 30 minutes or an hour or during the course of a day with good concentration will be amazed at the endless capacity of this mind to endlessly present all sorts of material. Right? It is just all over the place. It knows no boundaries. It knows no boundaries of past and future, and it knows no boundaries of real or imagined. Right? It is capable of everything and anything. It is capable of the most wholesome thoughts and feelings, and is capable of the most unwholesome thoughts and feelings. And then that can change in 5 minutes. That can change in a minute. So this mind is a mystery, how it unfolds. Please listen. And yet, it is the source, the very source of our happiness, and it is the very source of our suffering. It is the key piece in Buddhism, and it must be understood, and it needs to be understood so it can be transformed. There are many wonderful religious practices out there and religious systems that teach good things, right? Buddhism does not have the corner on teaching good things. The right way to be, the right way to act, morality, etc. So one might wonder why with all this good religious teaching going around for thousands of years, do people who so-called followers of these religions seem to have a great incapacity to practice, to follow through? We might even wonder why it is that teachers, priests of these various religions, including Buddhism, even though they have studied and read and they can expostulate and give sermons on all these things in great wonder and beauty, still are capable of greed, right? All the sexual scandals and the drug scandals and the embezzlement scandals and the power-hungry scandals. You might wonder, how can that be, right? It's because they don't do the inner work that the Buddha is setting forth here. So what you have very typically is this mind, this monkey mind, and this mind full of wholesome and unwholesome mental formations, and on top of that is imposed spirituality or religiosity or morality. Right? And so it becomes a good act. And some people act very well. Right? Just go to theater. Just watch a movie, right? There are people who are great actors. Right? And you might wonder, Oftentimes, when you see somebody in a certain role, acting in a certain role, you may wonder, when you hear about the things they do in their real life, you might go, oh, how can that be? Gee, they were so pure in such and such a role. How could that be? They were acting. And they were good actors. And there are many people who practice spirituality, religion, who are good actors. We don't want to be good actors here. We want to be real. And to be real, we have to go into the mind, the source of our wholesome and unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind, and do the work that needs, so these can be, you know, some can be uprooted, some can be transformed, some can be ignored. There are all many ways, as somebody asked me. There are many ways of dealing and transforming the mind. Right? But the bottom line, it has to occur if transformation and awakening is real. So this is good work. Now again, I mean, everybody kind of looking at me very seriously. Again, it's serious stuff, but it's also joyous stuff. You know, in the meditation on gladdening the mind, oftentimes when you read the commentary on that, one of the things it says to gladden your mind is to be grateful that you have a path. You know, think about how wonderful it is that I've come encountered with the Dharma in this life. I've come encountered with teachers. I know a way how to deal with my suffering and how to transform it. I found a way how to learn how to be a compassionate, loving being, right? I mean, that should make us happy, right? That gladdens the mind. Reflecting on the preciousness of life and the wonders of life. The wonders of relationship, the wonders of love. That we have capacity to love. We know animals have a lot of good capacities. And there is some evidence that certain animals do have the capacity to love. But we would say human beings, that's available to all human beings, that capacity, in terms of our evolution through the six realms. We have a funny mind. We tend to perversely love to dwell on things that make us unhappy. We love to dwell on things and situations and people in such a way that it only waters our unwholesome seeds. Right? It's bizarre, isn't it? And again, I can say that, and you can nod, but it must be understood. You know, in Buddhism there is this word realization. You often hear realization. Realization means I've realized it in my body mind. I know it. I just don't know it here. I've realized the truth of it. And the only way we'll realize the truth of what we're talking about today is if we do that work of slogging through the muck, as well as doing the work of attaining the high points, the outlooks, where the view is vast. We need to understand the closed, constricted, knotted up, hurtful, resentful, egocentric mind, and we need to know the mind of love and openness and acceptance, right? When we know it deeply within ourselves, not just as teaching, not just because it's been taught to us, but because we know it through our own deep dealing with these aspects of ourselves, can we really, from the inside, make the choice to walk the path of wholesomeness, to walk the path of goodness, right? And to learn how to deal skillfully and mindfully and intelligently and more quickly with the unwholesome mind states that will continue to arise. So, you know, this capacity to breathing in and out to observe the mind, the phenomena of the mind, and to know not simply thoughts and feelings, but to know more strongly mind states. I'm aware when there's desire in me. I'm aware when there's craving in me. I'm aware when there's resistance in me. I'm aware when there's anger in me. I'm aware when there's attachment in me, right? Et cetera, et cetera. I'm aware when there's impatience in me. And we got to stop making excuses. Right? Well, this is not a big one, right? But a little impatience is on the continuum of big impatience. And big impatience is on the continuum of anger, you know? And so, a small fire is a fire. You know, we can't make believe it's not. A small fire is a fire. And you know, with a small fire, all you need is a little bit of fuel or a good wind and what? You can have a raging inferno. So the work on our minds has to be fairly consistently precise. And we can't, in terms of anger, we can't just set the bar at rage. I haven't shot anybody in years. I must be, and in a certain sense, that is true. But again, as we know, in the Alaya Vijnana, in our storehouse consciousness, there are the seeds of all these things. And if the seed is still there and it's strong, even though it comes up because of the situation lightly, it means it's still there. So it still needs to be tended. It still needs to be wrapped in our awareness and needs to be dealt with skillfully. Now, people say, tell me what to do. Well, there are a number of things you can do. To me, it's like if you have a child, right? Sometimes you what? Or a young person. Sometimes you just hold them, right? And that's enough. Sometimes you have to talk to them softly to soothe and calm them. Sometimes you have to redirect them. If there are any teachers in the room, we know about redirection. Right? Sometimes we have to redirect this mind of ours. Sometimes we have to provide alternatives, very clearly. We're angry at somebody, we're seeing all the negative faults, we have to do loving kindness meditation. We have to provide an antidote. Right? Sometimes we have to be stern. Right? Sometimes we just have to shut up with this. Say nothing. We've got to be stern. Become like, as Shanti Davis says, become a block of wood. Right? Sometimes we need to restrain that mind of ours because it's just up to no good. Right? And so, again, it's easy to take a formula, but a formula is too narrow and it won't meet all the circumstances. It really, I guess what I'm suggesting to each of us is when we know our minds and we have a repertoire of ways that we tend it. We are mind tenders. There's a koan or something where someone asks a master and he says, what's your practice? I tend my ox. That's his practice. I tend my monkey mind. I tend my ox. I tend my untrained wild horse. I train my puppy. You can look at it in different ways. I'm helping the child in me grow up. I'm working with kind of an acting out adolescence and adolescent inside me. That's what I'm taking care of these days, like that. So it's not just one answer, right? But it's you have to know who you're dealing with, You have to have a repertoire of skills so you can deal carefully and intelligently so this part of us can grow up. Right? So this mind tetrad is key for our practice. So please practice it diligently. Concentration means what? It means mindfulness implies the capacity to know what's going on right in the present. Right? Concentration is making a conscious choice to focus. Right? So mindfulness can move from one thing to another to another. I am mindful, I'm present to what's ever before me. When I'm concentrating, I'm saying, I am now going to focus on this one thing. Right? So now I'm going to focus on cultivating compassion, let's say. I'm going to be very concentrated. I'm going to be very concentrated on looking deeply into impermanence. Right? I've kind of, one thing. Right? I'm not attending to sounds or smells or sights. I'm just watching my mind. I'm concentrated. Is that clear? So I'm just concentrating my breath. Because when we are mindful of our body, there are all kinds of sensations. I could be mindful of my heartbeat, right? I could be mindful of my breath. I could be mindful of the way my right toe is. What's the life of my right toe right now? And we'd find out that our right toe has a life unto itself, that maybe is very important to it. So it's like that. We can choose to concentrate on anything, but it means that we're giving it single-minded attention. And then that capacity to liberate the mind. Thich Nhat Hanh, he kind of uses the phrase, untie the knots. It's a nice phrase. Liberating the mind is just wherever it's knotted, we untie it. And you can see all attachments and aversions are knots. They're a place where we're stuck. They're a place where the energy isn't flowing. They're places where there's not a great deal of openness. So our work is just to untie our knots. Now, how do we know that we have knots? It's only through mindfulness, awareness of our mind, that we know that that the reason I'm feeling this way or talking this way is because somewhere inside me I am knotted up. Right. So in this practice is we're looking for the knots, right? Before we tell somebody what we really think of them. We're going, what's the knot inside me? What is the knot in my mind? What is the knot in my heart right now? And let me first untie that. When that is untied, we may respond to the situation very differently than if we're responding all knotted up. Again, it doesn't mean that practitioners, we become passive people, right? We can relate, we can interrelate, we can act in the world, but we don't. We do our best not to act from our knots. Is that clear? When we are unknotted and there's clarity, and the energy is flowing, and there's openness, and there's the capacity to see many points of view. And there is understanding of causes and conditions. Causes and conditions that have created the situation that has brought me to where I am, and causes and conditions that have brought the other people or the situation to where it is, then I can act, or I have a better chance of acting skillfully and compassionately. So untying the knots. But that has to be our aspiration, doesn't it? bodhisattvas don't have an aspiration to get even. That is not found in the canon of the bodhisattva literature. Right. Bodhisattvas do not have the aspiration to increase suffering for themselves and others. That's not the aspiration of a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas do not have the aspiration to contribute to confusion, perpetuate ignorance. That's not in the bodhisattva canon. So, again, the practices of the bodhisattva, the literature of the bodhisattva, are all important for us so we can cultivate, you know, this deeper aspiration. If our aspiration isn't clear, then in the situation, we will revert to what we know, to what we're conditioned by. And we know for most of us, we are conditioned by egocentricity. We are often conditioned by unwholesomeness. We are often conditioned by hindrances, the 5 and 10 hindrances, the 3 poisons, you know, greed, anger, delusion. Unfortunately, for many of us, this is very much the conditioning of our mind, especially when things are difficult. You know, when things are easy, everything's going well, you know, what is that? There's this saying in Tibetan Buddhism where they say, you know, when everything's going well in the world, everybody looks like a great practitioner. Everybody's happy and things are good. Everybody's treating everybody nicely, right? But it says you only know the real practitioners when the times are bad. Because then you'll see the difference. Right? You know, if everybody's praising us and loving us and telling us how wonderful we are, you know, birthday party kind of time. you know, we shouldn't get any credit for being happy. We shouldn't get any credit for being open and loving, right? I mean, right? But if everybody is castigating us, that's the time. For us to know about the state of our bodhisattva practice. That's the test. So I guess at our birthday brunch in April, I expect a good roasting from you. So, the 7 factors of awakening. So yesterday we looked at the first 3. The first factor, remember, was mindfulness. The second factor was investigation of dharmas. The 3rd factor was energy or persistence. So again, in terms of checking our practice, you know, if because we use words like awakening, you know, I want to wake up. I want to be more awakened. So these gives us some criteria. Those of us who like criteria, how is my mindfulness? How often during the day am I really present? Present to what's ever in front of me, present to my mind, you know, the four establishments of mindfulness. How present am I to my body breath? How present am I to feeling sensations? How present am I to mind and mental events? And how present am I to the phenomena that's arising to my senses? Right? And I'm sure as mindfulness seems to be entering the mainstream of psychology and medicine, I'm sure there will be, right? Diane is a researcher. I'm sure there'll be good questionnaires and other kinds of criteria being developed that we can actually rate ourselves quite sophisticatedly about the quality of our mindfulness. I'm sure there'll be good questionnaires and other kinds of tests developed. So that's one way we can look. Again, the investigation of dharmas. How much time do I really spend looking at causes and conditions of things? Or do I just kind of skim along the surface? How deeply, when things arise in my own mind, when things arise in my life, rather than just dealing with them as they are, do I look more deeply? Right? To really understand what has produced this arising in this moment. Looking deeply, looking below the surface. Do I take the time to really investigate, again, within my own mind or within the conditions of others, to really look deeply, or you know, situation, politics, world situations. It's so easy to be superficial. But often if we go deeper, we can understand clearly why this is arising in a human being, in a political party, in a people, so we understand deeply why things are happening the way they are happening. When we understand deeply, because of our investigation of causes and conditions, then we have also a deeper capacity of really acting wisely. Not from a place of anger, not from a place of fear, not from a place of hurt or despair, and not from a place of self, but from a place of understanding. It's like we said earlier, when we hold our mental phenomena, we hold it in mindfulness. We don't hold it in self. If you hold it in self, you go, gee, what a jerk I am, or what a lousy practitioner I am, or you know what I mean, or I'm so disappointed in myself, or, right? I can't believe I still think like that. If that's what's coming up as you investigate your mind, you're not investigating your mind with mindfulness. You're investigating your mind with ego. Mindfulness has no self to it. Mindfulness just has awareness. In the same way, when we investigate the dharmas of the world, we don't have to investigate them with ego, self, my views, my. We want to understand. Bodhisattvas, that's what we do for a living. Right? We practice understanding. We practice compassion. Capacity to understand deeply the suffering of another. Then we have the capacity for upaya, for acting skillfully in terms of how we act in situations to remediate conflict, to remediate suffering, to help people get unstuck. Right? So we practice understanding. The third factor is energy or persistence. And we've spent some time so far in retreat talking about ceaseless practice. Somebody was saying yesterday in one of the talks, they were saying about certain practice how they always did pretty bad at it. And yet in talking to them, and had no energy for it, but in talking to them, it was clear they didn't like the practice. Not liking the practice or thinking the practice was kind of a Mickey Mouse kind of practice, they had no energy for it. Having no energy, they had no persistence, right? So we cannot practice like automatons. We cannot practice like Dharma robots. There has to be juice. And the juice is curiosity, interest. You know, in the meditation literature, the basic thing is we have to be interested in the meditation object. If there's no interest, if there's no curiosity, right? How are we going to sustain our attention? We won't. Right? We'll very easily get bored. We'll very easily get distracted. You know, am I really interested? Gee, it says if you practice the first four tetrads, the first four meditations on the breath and the body. One can achieve samadhi, a state of real unification and calmness and tranquility of mind. It's always been the result of that type of practice. Well, are you interested in finding out if it's true? Are you curious? If I really just stay with the practice persistently, right? Stay with the body breath, counting, labeling, being, whenever I stray, release, smile, relax, come back, will I begin to experience a deep kind of calmness and serenity and joy that will arise from within? That's what the teachers say. Do I want to experience that for myself? You see, now there's energy. Now there's energy in the practice. If we don't have that kind of curiosity or interest, it's again, we're always struggling with distractions. Okay. So there has to be energy, and the energy also comes from the other side. You know, like I'm sick of thinking about this stuff. No, I'm just done with it. Going over and over the same stuff, over and over again, same sorts of obsessions, same types of self-absorption, same type of stories. Right? So the other thing that can fuel and energize us is wanting a change. Right? So there are many ways to energize our practice. Traditionally in Buddhist meditation, impermanence, reflecting on impermanence, reflecting on death. Right, Sam, you had your... poor Sam, he's getting famous for his heart attack. I hope you don't take this kind of like... like this is your role or something. Sam was he had his heart attack when what? Drinking your coffee on a Sunday morning, right? Just ordinary Sunday morning, just hanging out with Marilyn, right?
Yeah.
Read the paper, did his practice, nice Sunday morning. Right? All of a sudden, that little link, that fragile link we have to life, almost ended. So traditionally, meditators meditate on impermanence and death, to energize it. So we don't sit there with a sense, la-di-da, 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 you know. If I don't get it together today, I'll get it together tomorrow, or next week, or next year. I've all the time in the world, right? That's the way we think, isn't it? We repeat the five remembrances every day. We reflect in these things. We read the Dharma, and then it's just la-di-da, la-di-da, la-di-da. We are a funny bunch, aren't we? in a lot of the Tibetan teachings. When they talk about sentient beings, they talk about you know unruly sentient beings. We are just an unruly lot. They're always up to some mischief. You know. So, first three are mindfulness, energy or persistence, and the investigation of dharmas. Now, when the practitioner has reached a stable, imperturbable, abiding in the stream of practice, the fourth factor of awakening will be born and developed in her, or him, the factor of joy. This is the fourth factor of awakening. And this again, as you will note, is saying, this is also in these four a natural progression. So it's really saying, when there is mindfulness, right? And when there is investigation, when there is the deep looking, when there is the persistence of practice, continuous practice, what will we begin to experience from the inside? That factor is sometimes translated as also like rapture. It's kind of strong. I mean, in English, it's kind of strong. But it really means a kind of happiness that comes from the inside. The mind is light. Many of us, our minds are heavy. Heavy with what? Heavy with the five hindrances, the ten hindrances, heavy with the negative emotions, heavy with memories, heavy, you know what I mean? Heavy with longings, heavy with desires, heavy with needs, heavy, right? Can you see? You kind of pile them on, and the mind gets heavy. Or the mind gets dark. So there is a quality of mind, and I'm sure everyone here has experienced it to one degree or the other, that when one is practicing mindfulness, when one is, and the, you know, for a moment the clouds kind of lift inside, you realize, oh, this mind is light. Right? This mind is clear. This mind is open. This mind is spacious. That's its natural quality. And this mind is naturally joyful. That's the true condition of our mind. We don't have to make joy. This is, a lot of people kind of have to really, a lot of people work at being happy. I'm sure you've run into those people who work incredibly hard at being happy. I mean, they get their life totally set up so they can be happy. You know, always got the music playing and, happy, happy, happy. Again, it's better. It's developmentally, it's better than being sad, sad, sad. But it's artifice. It's not. It doesn't come from within. So what's being talked about here is that there's a joy and a happiness that will come from within. You don't have to work at it anymore. You'll be happy just to be alive. Right? A master said, some master, Zen master, what is the meaning of life, master? He said, life is the meaning of life. You want to find the meaning of life? Live life. Live life fully. There's the meaning of it. You want happiness? Be open and present to every moment. Don't meet the moment with your own perceptions and conceptions, preconceptions, agendas. Like that. When this factor is developed, it will come to perfection. And again, that is the way, if you've noticed, all of them have ended. When this factor is developed, it will come to perfection. When this factor is developed, it will come to perfection. Factor is developed. So again, this is a developmental model. Okay, it is saying these seven factors of enlightenment are present as we move along the path, but when they are present, they develop. They will be developed. And eventually they come to perfection, and someone who has developed these seven to perfection is called a Buddha. That's how you get there. That's the name we give to someone who's developed this to perfection. They're Buddhas. When the practitioner can abide undistractedly, there he goes again, continuously, undistractedly, in the state of joy, he will feel her body, his body, and mind light and at peace. At this point, the fifth factor of awakening will be born and develop, the factor of ease. When this factor is developed, it will come to perfection. Now, this is also often translated as serenity, serene. So ease, serenity. You know, there is a posture of that you'll sometimes see bodhisattvas in. It's called the posture of royal ease. It's something like this. They're just kind of, they're like that. They have one leg up. They're looking serene. They're at ease. They're not in the meditation posture. They're not. They're just like that. It's a wonderful kind of mudra of the body. It's called the mudra of royal ease. The mudra of serenity. Serene. It means what? It means nothing. Nothing's upsetting us. Nothing's disturbing us. Nothing's perturbing us. We're not mulling over the past. We're not worried about the future. We're not, you know, we're at ease. We're not asleep. We're just at ease. Body's at ease. Mind's at ease. So we can ask ourselves, how much ease do I cultivate in my life? Do I experience in my life? How much serenity do I have? Real serenity. Not acting serene. We can act serene, right? I've been in spiritual communities where great actors. Everybody knows how to act serene. Keep their eyes down. Keep a little serene look on their face. They talk in a soft voice. You know, and yet you get to know these people and watch out. But, you know, it takes time because... And then you wonder, when you hear about these things that go on in these communities, you wonder where they come from. They all seem such like such nice, serene people when I was there. So it's a serenity that comes from the inside. It's not a serenity that's put on from the outside. Ease. Easy. I don't make a big deal about things. I don't make a big deal about myself. I don't make a big deal about what I'm doing. I don't make a big deal about my past. I don't make a big deal about it, right? I'm at ease. Right? Like that. I don't make a big deal about being sick. I don't make a big deal about getting old. I don't make a big deal about it. I'm at ease with the unfolding of life. Not a lot of drama and ease is there. Again, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, that we just sit in the royal ease posture. We can have a life. And we can have jobs, and we can have relationships, and we can be involved in our communities, and you know, do good. Right? But can we do it with ease? Things aren't such a big deal. I'm not attached. When you're attached, there's no ease. Is there? When you're averting, there's no ease. We're always in the active mode then. Pushing and pulling and giving and getting, and right, it's a manipulative kind of life, and it's exhausting. So, ease, another factor of awakening. And again, please, a number of people have talked about taking notes or journaling and stuff. These are all being these are all being recorded. You can listen to them, and you can take notes on them, and journal about them all you want. So please know that's one of the reasons that we record it. So that is for those of you who learn in that way. Please, that's available to you. The reason I ask you not to take notes here, because in the Zen tradition. Dharma talks, remember I said earlier, Dharma talks are in a retreat in Zen. There's the meditation, there's the Dharma talks, and there's the private interviews. Those are the traditionally the three kind of components of a traditional retreat. And traditionally, a Dharma talk is not just an intellectual exposition of Dharma. Actually, a Dharma talk, the teacher is not talking to your intellect. The teacher is trying to get past your intellect to get into something, to awaken something deeper inside you. Again, I've said it before, I'll probably say it many times again. If we were capable of acting on what we intellectually know, I know this group here, we would all be fully enlightened Buddhas, because we have all read, heard, attended retreats ad infinitum. We have enough knowledge inside us to give spawn to endless, not just become a Buddha, endless Buddha worlds. Unfortunately, it's not about that. The sixth factor of enlightenment. When body and mind are at ease, the practitioner can easily enter into concentration. I think this is very interesting, that the concentration comes here. Now, it doesn't mean that that we use this as an excuse to say, well, then I can guess I don't have to concentrate until I get the other five. But I think what he's saying that, and again, you know, if we don't see this as step by step, and we don't think we need perfection, we can see they all kind of interact with each other. They all kind of interbe with each other. But we can see when there is greater mindfulness, right? We are living more in the present moment. We're living less in our thoughts. When we are looking more deeply into reality, so we have a deeper understanding of things. When our practice is more continual and energetic, when there's when there's greater lightness or joy or something like that, and there's more ease in our mind, right? We're less attached, less negative. then concentration is easier. Right? That's what he's saying. It just becomes more easy. When both body and mind are at ease, the practitioner can easily enter into concentration. That's one of the reasons, when we meditate, and often I begin in our local sanghas with a guided meditation, and here they also say to you, begin at ease. Before you take up your meditation practice, go into your body mind, relax your body mind, right? Find your body, find your breath, spend a little time just stilling, quieting. So when the mind is empty-er, when the mind is empty-er, and when there is more ease and relaxation in the body-mind, and when we've kind of, done a little body practice or just practice that lets us, I am sitting, like when we come to weekly sangha, a lot of people are sitting there, but their minds are still at work, or they're still in the future, or they're still doing their to-do lists, and Sandy said taxes, you know what I mean? So it often, we need to spend a little time just cultivating these factors. And then it'll be easier to concentrate. But you can see, if we haven't even in that practice period, having brought forth these factors, even to a small degree, it is difficult to concentrate, right? And people might wonder, why is it so difficult for me to concentrate, right? Well, because these other factors are not present. So these factors, please understand, are present, one can look at them in terms of, like we were doing earlier, how am I doing in my life with these factors, but also we can look at it in the moment, right? Right now, in terms of my practice, is mindfulness present? Is looking deeply present? Is continuous practice, energy practice? Is there a good feeling of ease and serenity and happiness in my body and mind? Right? Oh. So in a moment, in a practice period, we can check to see whether these factors are present. And if they're not, what we've been doing over the course of the retreat is learning ways to do that. Oh, no, my mind still thinking about what that SOB did to me earlier today. Well, maybe it's time to do what? To practice loving kindness, right? To generate some positive energy, right? Maybe we're feeling kind of deficient and worn out, and so maybe it's time to meditate on the preciousness of human life and to think about all the good things we have in life that we should be grateful for, right? So we can gladden the mind. Does that make sense? The practice gives us lots of tools for us to use, right? My mindfulness is really bad. All right, well, maybe I need just to listen to sounds, right? When I go into my mind right now, there's too much going on. I get swept away. I don't have a place of stability. Well, maybe I need to just listen to sounds, or look at an object and let my mind quiet down, or just come into my breath and go to a certain part of my body and hold it there. Right? So I can have some mindfulness before I take up concentration. So again, these are statements of characteristics of an awakened mind, but they're also telling us they're also a recipe, right, which we can use, in our lives throughout our day. When the practitioner is abiding in concentration with deep calm, he or she will cease discriminating and comparing. At this point, the seventh factor of awakening is released, born, and developed in her, him, the factor of letting go. When this factor is developed, it will come to perfection. I thought so. Yeah, what Thay is, I'm using Thay's translation. What he's translating as letting go is traditionally it's upeka, which means equanimity. So he's calling it letting go is a little more active, but it's equanimity. And in the footnote it says, the notion of giving up, discriminating, and comparing subject-object, like-dislike, gain-loss, is fundamental. The Buddhism of the Mahayana school has fully developed this concept. So the seventh factor of awakening is this equanimous mind. The mind that does not discriminate subject, object, me, you, good from bad, right from wrong. Doesn't mean on the relative level there isn't a right or wrong, but in that place it understands that there's something deeper. It understands that there can be no wrong unless there's a right. Right and wrong are dual. One cannot exist without the other. If you don't set up the standard of right, you won't have a standard of wrong. If you don't have a ceiling, if you don't have a concept of ceiling, you'll never have a concept of a floor. They go together, right and left. If you have a left hand, it has to be a right hand. If you have no right hand, how can you call this a left hand? It's just this. This is just this. But then we go, oh no, but there's one's over there and one's over there. I'll call this one right, I'll call this one left. Now we have a right hand and a left hand. That's all. It's just convenient. But this has never called itself a right hand. And this has never called itself, it doesn't know from that. It just knows this. So the seventh factor is letting go. The seventh factor is equanimity. In equanimity, what? Everything is equal. So again, they praise us and tell us how much they love us. We say, thank you. They defame us and tell us how much they hate us, we say, thank you. It's like that. Equanimity. Things go good in the world, that's okay. Things go bad in the world, that's okay. Like that. It's not easy, is it? Because why? Because we're attached. We want things to be a certain way. We want our retirement account to go which way? Up. Only up. Right? What happens? We live in Florida. We want our housing values to go which way? Up. How dare they go down? That wasn't in the plan, was it? How silly we are. So equanimity means what? Now, it does. It's not an intellectual. You know, I mean, again, to understand this philosophically, Greeks were great philosophers. You find a lot of traditional philosophy that is very Buddhist. Again, the difference is that we develop our equanimity by this introspection. We understand the nature of reality. We understand the nature of causes and conditions. And more deeply, we understand non-self, shunyata. Emptiness. Because of that, we can sit in a place of ease and serenity and joy in the midst of the up and down, the back and forth. because we're not getting our happiness. You know, if you look at these seven factors of enlightenment, they're not coming from our retirement portfolio. That's not what the Buddha's saying here, is he? He's not saying that all these that serenity and ease and peace of mind and joy is coming from how many friends we have and how well liked we are, and how many people have praised us in the last 24 hours, and you know, and how many accolades we've received, and how many degrees we have, or how much money, you know, right? From none of that. It's interesting. And it's because that the Buddha is teaching us another way to find happiness and ease and meaning in life, we can be in this life and not be tossed about by it. And this can only come about by practice, practicing the teachings, practicing the practices. There's no other way, unfortunately. You know, we have a great a pharmaceutical industry here in America. They are geniuses at finding pills for everything. But they have not yet found the pill for the seven factors of awakening. Now, I'm sure somewhere there's somebody working on it. So we may get corrected at some point. But up to now, there's no pill that gives wisdom. There's no pill that gives consistent ease without addiction. So this can only be found by practice. So the Buddha ends this section by saying, because the section before was on the four establishments of mindfulness, he says, this is how the four establishments of mindfulness, if developed and practiced continuously, will lead to perfect abiding in the seven factors of awakening. Section 5. How will the seven factors of awakening, if developed and practiced continuously, lead to the perfect accomplishment of true understanding and complete liberation? I'm glad I read this. Yeah. Sam wasn't satisfied just with the perfection of the four establishments of mindfulness or the perfection of the seven factors of awakening. He was saying, where's true understanding and complete liberation? Right? Good. How will the seven factors of awakening, if developed and practiced continuously, lead to the perfect accomplishment of true understanding and complete liberation? If the practitioner follows the path of the seven factors of awakening, living in quiet seclusion, observing and contemplating the disappearance of desire, he or she will develop the capacity of letting go, or equanimity. This will be a result of following the path of the seven factors of awakening and will lead to the perfect accomplishment of true understanding and complete liberation. Letting go. Could the practice be as simple as that? Yeah. So many practices, so many teachings, right? It's like a funnel. And it all comes down to letting go. You might ask, what is it that I need to let go of? I might answer, everything. You might ask, what is it that I need to let go of? I might answer, whatever you're holding on to. then you might say, but what will happen if I let go? And I might say, are you interested or curious about finding out? Right? You know what it's like to hold on. Some of you know how it's like to hold on very tightly. Right? So you know what it's like to hold on. Are you curious about what it's like to let go? Section 6. This is what the Lord, the Awakened One, said. And everyone in the assembly felt gratitude and delight at hearing his teachings. So it's a little before 12. Why don't we stop here? And tomorrow we'll, a little bit from, I'm only holding it up because of the rate we've been going, just in case I don't get there. This is the book, Master Tang Hui. Maybe we'll just have you pronounce it whenever you do. First Zen teacher in Vietnam and America, and China. First Zen teacher, and again, it's a book, I would imagine he probably wrote in Vietnam and was translated. Actually, I could look it up and see, but most people don't know, but Thay Nhat Hanh, he's known for, so some of the books that are out now are really just his talks and retreats, but he's written over 100 books himself, and in Vietnam, he wrote, maybe one day Jun will give a teaching on it for us, but I think he wrote like a 3-volume history of Buddhism in Vietnam, quite a scholarly treatise. I think he wrote it before he left Vietnam when he was young. It's amazing when you go back and see the actual things he wrote in Vietnamese, what a history he has of scholarship. Well, I don't know, I could be wrong, we'll find out. It said this book is a translation of something that was published in Paris in 1998 in Vietnamese. So that's when it was first published, but again, it might have, he might have written it in Vietnamese long before then. It's a little different than a lot of the ones he's written, because it has history, and it has a few texts by the master, and then his commentary on the text. So we'll do our best to at least read a little something tomorrow. Remember, continuous, ceaseless. That's our watchword.